Okay, so, wow, it's been quite an eventful January, hasn't it? A lot of sickness happening and weather and different things, but I'm glad you all made it tonight, and myself as well. How many of you were here the last time we had Wednesday night service?
When was it?
I can tell you. I think it was 2 weeks ago.
Okay, I think so. I think it was 2 weeks ago. Yes.
Was that the 9th?
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right. Several of you were. Some of you weren't. It was the 16th, and it 2 weeks ago on the 16th was the Wednesday evening that I took another shot at John 6, okay? And I went home that night and was reading a little bit later in John, and a couple things that Jesus says there just, well, they would have knocked the socks off of me, except I was already in bed and didn't have socks on, so I was surprised. And so that combined with the fact that some of you weren't here, I think I have my thoughts a little better in order. I'm going to do a quick review of what we did and then extend it in a couple of ways. First of all, to look at those passages, which I didn't take into account, which occur in later chapters. And then also, since this discussion largely centers on verse 44, the passage where Jesus says, to paraphrase, you can't come unto me except the Father draw you. And the way I'm understanding that is not to suggest that God has to draw you in order to be saved individually, but rather Jesus is talking about the fact that the people couldn't even begin to apprehend him in the way that they were trying to. I do want to respond to any concerns you might have that I do believe God draws us. It's not that I'm suggesting there's not a drawing by God. And we'll talk about, I got seven different ways here in which he draws us. It's just that that passage is not, to the best of my understanding, one that is talking about that. Okay, so the key to understanding verse 44 centers on not so much an emphasis of the words he used, but on the bigger picture of what was happening in his ministry at this point in time. Chapter 6 starts with an account of Jesus going across the Sea of Galilee, and quite a number of people, about 5,000 men plus women and children, followed him there, and Jesus undertook to feed them. Well, after this miracle, in verse 14, we have these words, then those men, when they had seen the miracle that Jesus did, said, this is of a truth that prophet that should come into the world. When Jesus therefore perceived that they would come and take him by force to make him a king, he departed again into a mountain himself alone. Okay, so this sets the stage for really the next three chapters of John. This interaction between Jesus and the masses, most of whom didn't believe on him, but who were attracted by his miracles to try to take him by force and make him a king. It's easy not to notice those words that John inserts there, but that really does form the basis for the dynamic of the interaction between the crowd and Jesus in the coming verses. So, what we see here then in chapter 6 is Jesus got away from them. He wasn't going to be used by them in that way. His disciples went back across the sea. The next day, the people saw the disciples were gone. Jesus was gone. They noticed Jesus didn't go with the disciples, but he was gone. And so they went across the sea as well. Well, when they got there, in the meantime, Jesus had come across by the, the over-the-water route and got a ride the last little bit. But they were like, how did you get here? We know that you didn't go with your disciples and there weren't any other boats there. How did you get here? They are still, in their minds, on this quest of finding him, coming to where he is, and making him king. And we find that the first thing he does is ignore their question and warn them. He said, you seek me not because you saw the miracles, but because you did eat of the loaves and were filled. Labor not for the meat which perisheth, but for that meat which endureth unto everlasting life, which the Son of Man shall give unto you, for him hath God the Father sealed. And so they're distracted and take off on another topic here for a little bit, but don't lose sight of what's in the back of their mind. They get into a discussion about the manna from heaven and the attitude that they have here. Jesus says something about the bread from heaven. They're like, oh yeah, Moses gave us bread from heaven, as it's written. And Jesus says, no, Moses didn't give you any bread from anywhere. Besides that, my Father giveth you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is he that cometh down from heaven and giveth life unto the world. And they're like, okay, whatever, give us this. Give us this life, or this bread. Jesus said, I am the bread of life. He that cometh to me shall never hunger. He that believeth on me shall never thirst. But this I said unto you, that ye also have seen me and believe not. All that the Father giveth me shall come to me, and him that cometh to me I will in no wise cast out. For I came down from heaven not to do mine own will, but the will of him that sent me. And this is the Father's will, which hath sent me, that of all which he hath given me, I should lose nothing, but should raise it up again at the last day. And this is the will of him that sent me, that every one that seeth the Son and believeth on him may have everlasting life, and I will raise him up at the last day. And being that the Jews, this group of Jews in general, didn't believe on him, they find all sorts of reason to drag their feet, to murmur, to complain. And so when he said this, they murmured. When he says, I am the bread which came down from heaven. They said, isn't this Jesus, the son of Joseph, whose father and mother we know? How is it then that he saith, I came down from heaven? Jesus therefore answered and said unto them, murmur not among yourselves. No man can come to me except the Father which hath sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day. And so my suggestion here is that reference that Jesus is making there is not that no man can come to me in faith. It's not that no one can trust me for salvation except that God somehow individually draw him in some sort of predestined way. But rather, this is back in the light of Jesus establishing who he is as the Son of God. They're still in the mindset of, this guy has got a lot of valuable assets here. We want to make him king. We know who he is, though. We know his father and his mother. And we can find him. We can go to where he is. We can compel him to do what we want. And he's answering that issue. No, you can't. You can't come to me except the Father draw you. And so, literally, he's speaking of where he will be, back in heaven. And the the sense of draw there we should look at as well, because that is of interest. So there's primarily two uses of this word. The first one has the implication that the object being moved is incapable of propelling itself or unwilling to do so voluntarily. And so we see in most uses of this word in the New Testament, you have the Apostle Paul being drawn out of the temple. You have a sword being drawn out of a sheath. You have fishes being drawn in a net. And so the object that's being described as being drawn is being moved from one place to another, not of its own volition, not of its own will, not of its own capability. It's just being moved. It's a way of saying you're getting moved. And if you think about what has to happen to get us to heaven, we're going to have to be drawn there by the Father, right? You can't get there on any kind of Segway that I know of. There's no kind of ped or plane or anything else that will make that transition. So even though at first I thought it was a bit of an odd word to use in that way, it's really not at all. The other sense in which it is sometimes used is in the sense of drawing and attracting. And so we have Jesus in John 12 who uses it when he says, "If I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me." Well, certainly he doesn't mean that all men are going to be without their own will saved because he's crucified. But there is an attraction that results from what Jesus did on the cross. So that's the other sense of the word. But that doesn't happen often in the New Testament. So the draw doesn't cause a problem with understanding it in this way. And the context really demands it. Now, two other things that I want to look at quickly along that line. I noted, I think last time in verse 65, that Jesus quotes himself and doesn't use exactly the same words he used before. In verse 65, he says, "Therefore I said unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father." And so he doesn't use the draw word there, but that shows you that the critical point is you can't come to where I'm going to be. You can't get there without supernatural intervention, whether you talk about the Father drawing you or the Father giving it to you. The point is God does it. You can't get there otherwise. Now, I thought I had pretty good evidence there for that understanding until I read a little farther last 2 weeks ago and noticed in the next chapter Jesus says some more things. In verse 33 of chapter 7, let's do verse 32. "The Pharisees heard that the people murmured such things concerning him. And the Pharisees and the chief priests sent officers to take him." Okay, so in chapter 6, we had the people crossing the lake to take him, essentially. They're going to go to where he is. They're going to make him king to do their bidding. Here we have the people who are responding to his miracles, and the Pharisees are like, "Oh, we got to do something. This guy is a problem." They sent officers to take him. "Then said Jesus unto them, Yet a little while am I with you, and then I go unto him that sent me. Ye shall seek me, and shall not find me. And where I am, thither ye cannot come." What did he say in 6 verse 44? You cannot come to where I am. It's the same message to the same kind of people. People who are looking to take him. People who don't reckon on his true identity. The fact that in a very, very short time, he's going to be totally beyond their reach in every sense. And the only thing that they're going to be able to do to him even now is going to be what the Father allows them to do. You cannot come to to where I am. Then said the Jews among themselves, whither will he go that we shall not find him? They're pretty confident of their abilities, aren't they? We'll find you. Will he go unto the dispersed among the Gentiles and teach the Gentiles? What manner of saying is this that he said, ye shall seek me and shall not find me, and where I am, thither ye cannot come? And hopefully you can see the sameness of the concept between that reference and the one in chapter 6. And if that weren't enough, we go on.
Keith,
yes.
I'm just amazed at 37, where, in contrast, if you took it the other way, he immediately then says to the at large, any man who thirsts, let him come unto me.
If any man thirsts, let him come unto me and drink.
I hadn't noticed that.
Yes. Nothing about, well, if the Father lets you, or if the Father draws you, or whatever. It's the Father is drawing you through Jesus at that point. But, yes, thank you. And so then, if you read through the dialogue, we have the same kind of things going on. The people basically vacillating between whether to make him king or whether to kill him. So here then in chapter 8, we come down again to a critical statement by Jesus in verse 21. Then said Jesus again unto them, I go my way, and ye shall seek me, and shall die in your sins. Whether I go, ye cannot come. We have a trend here, don't we? This is his response to the unbelieving Jews that want to make his life useful to themselves, that want to take him, that want to impose on him what they want. He says, you can't even come to where I am. But being timeless, he wouldn't feel constrained to change the grammar a little bit as we do to where I will be. Because in our minds, well, he's not quite there yet, but he's speaking from a different perspective than we normally think. And so the point is that because of who he is and where he is, and in our perspective where he soon will be, they cannot come. So I submit to you how careful we must be not to take a single verse such as chapter 6:44 and suppose that we can take it by itself and somehow not have to reckon how it plays into the bigger picture of the text. You will find in a number of confessions and catechisms, is the word I'm looking for, that chapter 6, verse 44 is offered as a proof text for various Calvinistic doctrines. And there are people, I mean, I personally have struggled with the verse in the past, just taking it by itself, and well, what do you do with that? Well, what you do with that is you try to see how it fits into the bigger picture and don't generate a doctrine from it, which clearly contradicts verses around it, but which somehow we feel like, well, we've got to take it like it says it. Well, how does it say it? You don't know how it says it until you see the bigger picture, the bigger context.
You see how loving God is to alert.
And so that's what I want to talk about next. Having said that verse 44 of chapter 6 is not referring to God's drawing us in salvation, but rather Jesus telling his adversaries that they can't get to where he's going to be unless God provides the transportation. What about this matter of God drawing us? Does God draw us? And how does he draw us? Well, like I said, I have 7 headings here under how God draws us. I think number 1, we can say and see that God draws us to himself by his creation of us. In Genesis 1, verse 27, we have these words. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God created he him. Male and female created he them. If we are created in the image of God, there is a likeness and an affinity to God, which is a part of our very nature. So that if we are apart from him, we are not whole people. We are not whole beings. There's something missing in our existence. There's something empty. There's something lacking. And so I think, first of all, God has created us in such a way that we are drawn to him to find fullness of existence, fullness of life. And we won't have it any other way. That's a kind of drawing which doesn't take his action on a daily basis. That was something that he did by creation. But I think it's a very real thing. And those who have been lost from him but have come to him will often testify as to how empty their life was until they found themselves in God. Yes. Secondly, I think that God draws us to himself and has drawn us to himself by his actions in history. God has acted in the world. God has created, but he has acted as well. The Old Testament is a history of his actions, mostly with regard to the people of Israel, the children of Abraham. And as we read about God's actions with his chosen people, there is an attractiveness about it, about his faithfulness, about his justice, about his long-suffering with them, that has always attracted people to God. We find in the ancient world there were individuals from other nations that were attracted to the God of the Jews because of how God had acted in history. And so that is one way in which God has drawn us to himself in his dealing with his chosen people. Another huge action by God which draws us to him, of course, is expressed in John 3:16. Where we are told that because of his love, he sent his only begotten Son. That is God acting in history. That is an action which, unless we have very cold and stony hearts, draws us to him. There's a beautiful passage in Jeremiah 31:3, which speaks of God acting in history.
Is this a number four?
It's still about his actions in history.
Okay. Number two.
Yeah, number two. And under two, we had with through his chosen people, and then by sending his son as two big categories of his action. In verse three, we have, the Lord hath appeared of old unto me, saying, yea, I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Therefore, with loving kindness have I drawn thee. And interestingly, in the Septuagint, the Greek version of the Old Testament, this is the same word for drawn that we have, for instance, in John 6 and then in John 12, where Jesus says, if I be lifted up, I will draw all men to me. And so, this is not another point, it's just an illustration of Jeremiah expressing the actions of God through his love, through his loving kindness, drawing us to himself. I think the next category that I'd like to mention with respect to God's drawing us and how he does it, God draws us to himself by the life of Christ. He sent Christ, and that act alone is a sign of his love. It is an attractive thing. But then the life of Christ is a huge drawing for God, or toward God. We see in the life of Christ, in the Gospels, that here on earth, the crowds were drawn to him. In some cases, there were material benefits for them, and that was part of their attraction to him. But there were others that were attracted to him not because of those things, but because of the excellence and loveliness of his character, because of his grace. And then Jesus speaks of this in slightly different terms, and we find this in John chapter 17. And the language that he uses there is the language of glory. Now, we have sort of relegated glory to God alone and sort of lose track of how it affects us as human beings. But glory, in general, is something which is very attractive. You know what I mean? Even glory in the world's eyes. The celebrities, the athletes of this world who have reached a high pinnacle, have reached a position of glory in people's minds. And what do you see everywhere they go? They no longer have a private life. People throng them. People are drawn to them. People want to get close to them. People want their picture, their selfie taken with them, right? They want their autograph. But the point is, there's this huge attraction. Glory has that effect. If God is glorious in our mind, if we perceive him in that way, we are drawn to him. And so Jesus here in John 17, verse 4 says, I have glorified thee on the earth. I have finished the work that thou gavest me to do. And so this is all under the heading of how the life of Christ attracts us to God. The life of Christ attracts us to God because God glorified the Father. And by that means, we are attracted to him in ways that we otherwise wouldn't be.
You mean Jesus glorified the Father?
That's exactly what I mean.
Okay.
Did I say God did it?
Yeah.
Yes, we won't get technical about how that might be true, because that's not what I meant to say. Jesus glorified the Father by his life. So then the next heading I would offer is that God draws us to himself by the death of Christ. It's by the life of Christ. Christ glorified him. But also, even in death, Jesus glorifies the Father. And Jesus attracts us to himself and the Father by his selfless death. We could talk a long time about that, couldn't we? That is another way in which God draws us to himself. Number 5 in my list is this. How does God draw us to himself? He draws us to himself by offering us himself. He offers us the opportunity to know him. And it's the kind of knowledge which is not knowing who somebody is, but it's the kind of knowledge where they bring you close and you become a part of everything that they are. He gives us himself he offers to. That too we see in John 17. In verse 20, Jesus says, "Neither pray I for these alone, but for them also which shall believe on me through their word, that they all may be one, as thou, Father, art in me, and I in thee, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that thou hast sent me. And the glory which thou gavest me I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one, I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me, and hast loved them as thou hast loved me." And so we see here Jesus communicating to us the offer of the Father, the offer of himself to be one with us. That's an attractive thing. It's attractive if you're looking for something besides yourself. It's not particularly attractive if you're happy with what you got. But there's a good chance if you live very long in life, you won't be happy with what you got. And so this is a way that God draws us to himself, by offering us himself. Number six, it's kind of been alluded to here already in John 17, but God draws us to himself by the life, the love, and the unity of those who believe on Christ. In Matthew 5, Jesus tells those who are listening, presumably his disciples and would-be disciples, he says, "Ye are the salt of the earth. Ye are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven." And so if we are the salt and we are the light, and we are to display the works of God in man, we are a means of drawing others to him. I would also point out there in John 17, verse 23, "I in them, thou in me, that they may be made perfect in one, and that the world may know that thou hast sent me and hast loved them as thou hast loved me." So the life, love, and unity of believers is a means that God uses to draw others to him. And then lastly, I have listed through his Spirit. And I think probably many people would start here, and yet the scriptural references on this matter are fairly scarce. Not that I doubt it, it's just not as prominent as you might think. We have Revelation 22:17, where the revelator says, "And the Spirit and the Bride say, Come. And let him that heareth come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take the water of life freely." So it's a bit of a vague expression of what the Spirit's role might be. Quite often, the scriptural picture isn't so much that of an active drawing as it is just a general invitation. God's done the work of providing Jesus for us. He's available there. But it's up to you to make the move. It's up to you to make the move in that direction. I don't know of any strong discussion in the New Testament that pictures the kind of drawing we often think of with regard to God working in that way. He mostly works in these other ways we've mentioned. You can think of things like the even the parables. The parable of the lost son, if we're to use that as some sort of analogy to God's working, the father doesn't leave the house except at the last minute. When the son has already started that way, we don't have the father going out and searching, do we? There again, parables have limitations on to what extent they can be applied. On the other hand, the shepherd, in the case of the lost sheep, the shepherd does go searching for the sheep. So in that case, it's more like that picture of God working and moving. So it is not to suggest in any way that God isn't active in that way. But a note of realism, I think, does come to us through Paul in Romans. And I will visit that quickly, not the whole book, here at the last minute. Just to show you how Paul seems to be picturing the situation. He says, "For whosoever shall call upon the name of the Lord shall be saved." That's great news. That's not a picture of God going out and drawing, right? It's available, whosoever shall call upon the Lord shall be saved. And so Paul's reasoning here, he says, well, how then shall they call on him in whom they have not believed? And how shall they believe in him of whom they have not heard? And how shall they hear without a preacher? And how shall they preach except they be sent? And so this seems to be, in his mind, the sequence of events that God usually uses. God speaks through those who proclaim the truth about his working in history, who proclaim the truth of the life of Christ, who proclaim the truth of the death of Christ, and of God's offering himself to us, and who are living the life of Christians before them. That's the primary means that he uses to draw people. And even in creation, I think probably there are people who are drawn to God without understanding why, but until they have somebody who can show them the way, can show them the truth, can show them Jesus, they just have the sense of longing. They don't know what they're longing for. They can't identify with the full reality, who is Jesus after all, until somebody has proclaimed that, which is why we have missionaries. So
I think it's very likely that, in my understanding, in the circles I've grown up in, we've used that same word draw from that same verse, although we didn't apply it the way the Calvinists did, but that's how it's become a part of our vernacular and how we understand.
I think you're right, and it's like, well, yeah, that's true. And it is true, but maybe in a little different way than we tend to assume. Because when you start looking at other, it's just, I challenge you to find some verses that I've missed here, some passages I've missed. But it's certainly not readily evident that that particular picture is emphasized in the New Testament.
I'm noticing it. I believe I've been reading Psalms and Proverbs, and I can't remember which it is. I think it's Psalms. There are several verses that talk about him, his eyes scanning and looking for those who are, you know, reaching for him. Not exactly him.
Right.
But he's looking. He's there, ready to respond.
And you know, we also have touching testimonies of individuals who look back on their life and say, you know, I feel like God was working here and was, and you know, in retrospect, we can see how we were moved by various things, but I think we'll still see, if you could analyze those situations, quite often those situations behind them are these other kinds of things. There are things about the people of God who were being faithful to the truth, who were being salt and light, that were the means of the drawing. And yes, it was God working through them, but in a little different sense than what we sometimes assume.
I think the spirit of conviction, too, is often used interchangeably with the capacity of drawing. Okay, I was convicted, I was moved by the spirit, was how it would have been said in my life. And we will say, well, that's how he drew you. So those are used interchangeably in my experience.
Although literally, most of us aren't terribly attracted by conviction, are we? You know, that's almost like, oh, let's go the other way here. This is not a positive thing, not a pleasant thing. But nevertheless, having said all of that, let me please be known as emphasizing that God has done an incredible amount to draw us to himself. Don't ever get the impression that I'm saying anything else. His love is unspeakable. And yet, it requires action on our part. His love for us is not irresistible. We can turn it down. One of the things that John seems to marvel at as he's recounting the deeds of Jesus and the reaction of the people to them is that in spite of all these things Jesus was doing, still they didn't believe on him.
It helps so much. It helps me a lot how you have taken this and helped us to see how it progresses, Jesus, in relation to these people who he started out with there were fed a miracle, and then you follow that through. It's a tremendous help to me.
Well, it is to me too, because this is new to me.
I can't remember, even in Bible school, maybe they did it and I didn't catch it, but to help us to see that flow, mm-hmm. conversation and incidents and what happened and how they wanted to use his life. Then they wouldn't have to go till their gardens.
Sure.
You're going to feed us on this small amount. Sure, we'll join you.
Right. Two, there was the desire to use him for political ends. They wanted to be off from under the bondage of the Romans. And so John helps us see the thread that moves through those chapters of that particular dynamic that otherwise we might lose sight of.
I thought about that number 5, offering himself. That latter part of John 6 tells us, eat my flesh, my blood, and will give you everlasting life.
Sure. So Jesus offers himself as well. Well, I think I'm finished with this now. If I don't go home tonight and read some more verses. I was quite astounded whenever I ran across those other two. Yeah, and it's the kind of thing you'd never find them by studying the word draw. They don't have the word draw in them. You find them by looking for you cannot come to me. And that's a repeated thing that he says to that group. You have no way to get to where I am, even though you think you're going to. And, you know, there's a certain irony in John's showing the Pharisees and the rulers behind the scenes are like, okay, take him down. You guys go get him. And then the reasoning, well, somebody's got to, if somebody doesn't die, the whole nation will go down. So he's going to be the one. And all the while, they think they're the ones that are masterminding the whole thing here. They're the ones that are in control. And Jesus is like, no, you can't touch me until it's my time. And then I will give myself to you. But in the end, you can't come to where I am unless you trust in me.
It's amazing how God can take a shepherd fellow or a fisherman like John, put him on the world stage, produce in his life something that he could never, had to be God behind him. This man was a fisherman. Did he, as far as I know, he didn't have any formal education other than what he got in his home or synagogue or whatever. Now look how, here, he's a world figure.
An eternal figure, too.
Sure. Right, and it's not to say, well, if you do it, if you're a good Christian, then you may be a world figure. The thing is, John's life, while we look at it and marvel, I don't think it's one that you need to be envious of. You remember he had some pretty tough times and ended up in exile on the Isle of Patmos. But the thing is, it doesn't matter. Those things don't matter if you're in God's will. If you're being used of him, you'll be happy. There's nothing so fulfilling as to be used of God to fulfill his ends. And then the other details really don't matter. But you don't seek that. You don't. That is to say, you seek to be used of him in the sense of making yourself available, but you don't decide ahead in your mind, well, I would like to be there. You know, I want to fill that position. I want that kind of status or glory. That's not how you get there. Jesus says you come in and you sit at the low seat. And then if the master says, no, I need you up here, then you can move up without any problem. But the last thing you want to do is try to start at the top and get moved down. That's not a pleasant thing. Well, anything particularly you'd like to pray about tonight?
The sick ones,
yes. Okay, remember those?
United Methodist Church is called a...